Welcome to episode 12 of the Ground to Sound podcast. Thank you so much for making it here. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts. Make sure to follow on Spotify. Today's episode features Adam Epstein. He is the head of A&R at Demolition Music Publishing. In this episode, Adam gives us the entire rundown from his first internship all the way to his current job today with Demolition Music Publishing. I really don't want to say much up top because he really gives his entire bio. We thought it'd be really cool that he talk about this, especially since he's coming up to his 25th year of working in the music industry, which is so huge, so important to him. And he was just such a cool guy, so great to talk to. So please enjoy my conversation with Adam Epstein. Just get right into it. I mean, you might be familiar that I do talk coffee with some people, although there have been a few that don't drink any coffee. So
I'm one of them, and I'll tell why.
Yeah, go ahead. Let's hear it.
So I don't, like, there's a few reasons I don't drink coffee. When I was a kid, I think I always thought that like cigarettes, coffee is bad for you. I've never touched a cigarette in my life either. I just, there was always something about it that like, I always thought it was, you know, bad for you. And I see, like, to this day, my mind is blown by like teenagers in high school drinking coffee. I was just never something I even thought of doing. Every once in a while, I also don't like hot beverages. I don't really drink, I don't know why. It's just a thing. Like, I don't drink hot tea either. My drink of choice is like unsweet iced tea. And then with coffee, it's just a matter of, every once in a while I'll have like a hankering for like an iced coffee or something. And then I'll drink one, and it's maybe like once every couple of years. It's that rare. I'll drink one and it makes me so jittery. I remember why I don't like, you know, that's another reason I don't like coffee. I'm somebody that wakes up in the morning and has never depended on any sort of like caffeinated beverage to wake me up. I just kind of, you know, have a half a glass of juice, some water, and I'm rocking and rolling. I prefer to be a little tired than caffeinated.
Interesting. Yeah. I guess you just fighting through the tiredness in that way. I mean, I can't say coffee works for everybody, but.
Right.
Yeah.
But, I think some people just kind of drink it because that's just what they do. That's part of the routine. Whether or not it actually helps them, I have no idea.
Right. I mean, I've heard from plenty of people that they don't even feel like it helps them very much anymore. It's more out of habit, which is interesting.
Right. And that's kind of what, I guess maybe that's when I was a kid and I said I never tried a cigarette. Maybe that's just, I just thought habits were bad, you know?
Right. So, okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see why you'd steer away from it. There's definitely a lot of negative connotation when you're a kid and you hear that stuff like it's going to stunt your growth. And, you know, I mean, obviously kids shouldn't be having it, but right. if you heard that a lot as a kid, I can see why, for sure.
Yeah, I think it's just that I probably watch too much TV and, you know, learn from there that cigarettes are bad and coffee is bad or whatever. You know, I don't really know. I can't, like, you know, pinpoint a specific moment. It's just something I never did. I just never drank coffee.
Right. Well, you know, being that you, you're in the music industry now,
yeah,
and you have been for a while, the A&R of Demolition Music Publishing. I was really curious about what music meant to you growing up, being that you're in the position that you are in now. How was that throughout your life?
Yeah, so, you know, growing up, like when I was a kid, you know, the stuff that my father listened to was, you know, the big singers. Like, you know, his favorite bands were like the Eagles and Queen, you know, just great songs with big singers. My mother liked more of the sort of like pop leaning stuff, like Cher and, you know, like Meatloaf, although the Meatloaf songs are incredible as well. But, you know, that's the kind of stuff she liked. I think the one that I can remember as a kid that, you know, being a New Yorker, everyone in the house agreed on always was, Billy Joel. You know, I have like some of my earliest childhood memories, you know, Billy Joel was always playing in the house. And then, you know, as I I moved to San Antonio, Texas when I was in high school, and Garth Brooks was, you know, the guy. And, you know, I remember Friends in Low Places broke, and my stepbrother and I were driving around and just blasting the song everywhere, and I just became obsessed with Garth Brooks. You know, I was more of like a rock, you know, a teenager, I was, you know, a rock guy, and I loved U2 and REM. And, but there was something about Garth Brooks, and then as I got more into him, I really started to listen to more country music in general, George Strait and, you know, a bunch of other ones. And I think that as I got more into high school, I was really still a rock guy, but I just, you know, living in Texas, you can't really avoid country music. So I just became a fan of that as well. And you know, this, you know, like today, like I always, people say, what's my taste? And I'm like, I don't have a taste. I don't discriminate against genres. If I like a song, I don't care what genre it is. If a good song is a good song, you know?
Yeah.
At sort of towards the end of high school, I got to go to my first couple of concerts, and the first one on my resume was Bob Dylan. A friend of mine won tickets to go see him in Austin, and I went. And you know, I didn't, you know, as a teenager, I didn't know much about Bob Dylan. You know, everybody, you know, I knew some of the classics, but I went to see him, and you know, I couldn't understand the word he said. You know, but as I got older and started to really appreciate songwriting, I certainly respect him. And, you know, I'm kind of like, it's cool for me to say that the first concert I ever went to was Bob Dylan.
Yeah, it's awesome.
And then there was another show I went to, which was, this is a funny little story. And I sometimes tell people this is how I got into the A&R world. I saw Soundgarden. And the opening act was Pearl Jam, and nobody knew who Pearl Jam was at that point. Soundgarden was, you know, already having it like on their second album and having success with like that song Outshined, which was huge for them. And I was just obsessed with Pearl Jam. And I kept going back to the record store back when there were record stores, asking the guy at the counter, like, did you get Pearl Jam? And he's like, I don't know what that is. And finally, I left my number, and he called me, and he's like, I got two copies of this album. I'll put one aside for you if you could be here in, like, the next hour or two. And I was like, I got there, and I bought it, and I listened to it. It was that first album there. It was called 10. And I was just, I thought that they were, like, you know, again, like U2 and The Police and REM, those were my bands. And I thought Pearl Jam was going to be, like, you know, this was my new band. So fast forward to like a month later, and they do MTV Unplugged, and now they're the biggest thing in the world, you know? And then that was kind of obviously the beginning of the grunge era with Nirvana and Alice in Chains and Soundgarden and Pearl Jam.
Yeah.
I had moved back to New York. My uncle was an entertainment lawyer, and, you know, I used to hang out with him a lot, as a teenager. And when I moved back to New York, and I was just kind of obsessed with what he did, you know, just working with, you know, in the music business with songwriters and producers. And he was Michael Bolton's attorney at the time. And that was in like the big heyday of Michael Bolton, you know, in the early 90s. And I just really just was fascinated by the music business. So, you know, while I was in school, I would just read any book I can get my hands on. And I got an assistant manager position at a record store in Staten Island called Coconuts Music and Movies.
Oh, yeah, we had Coconuts out here, too, in Jersey.
Yeah, yeah, it was right there on Richmond Avenue in Staten Island. And, you know, I loved it. Like, I loved seeing new releases come in, you know, on cassette and CD. I'm kind of dating myself saying that I was around when, you know,
yeah,
cassettes were a thing. And then I would do a lot of the paperwork, the inventory stuff. So I would just be, you know, cataloging CDs and albums of artists I'd never heard of in every genre, from classical to country to pop to rock. And while I was working there, that second Pearl Jam album came out, and I had never seen so many boxes of one CD in my life. You know, it was just like, you know, just massive, and people lined up outside the store for them. And it was just like, wow, I feel it. So I feel like, wow, I kind of called Pearl Jam.
Yeah, I mean, that's so cool to be around during that time and to really see that.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I saw them as an opening act, and then I went chasing the first album, and then now the second album's out and everybody's lined up for it. It's like, wow.
Yeah, you really
was my first, maybe that was my first real A&R experience.
Yeah, you got to see that progression. That's so cool.
So, you know, I that was kind of early 90s, I guess, and I really just wanted to be in the music business. I didn't have any idea what I wanted to do. I didn't know too much about, like, the different aspects of the business, you know, from publishing to record labels to management to, you know, legal to performing rights. I just, I knew that those things existed. I didn't know, like, what was what. So my uncle had gotten me an internship with Desmond Child and his manager, Winston Simone, and a guy named Brian Coleman, who, you know, really took me in. I worked really hard for a no-paying internship because I was just obsessed with learning as much as I could.
And this was the 90s?
And I was there.
This was like mid, this was like mid-90s around then?
So this was 1996, which this coming February will be 25 years since I started that internship.
Wow.
And, you know, to this day, I'm still very much part of that Desmond and Winston and Brian family. You know, Brian's like my older brother, and you know, Desmond and Winston are like mentors to me. And, you know, just has been like just a, you know, nonstop. Like, there's never been a bad moment in my history with those guys. Like, you know, just absolutely love them. And so, yeah, so I did that internship for a year. And at the time, it was a management company. So it was Desmond. There was a guy named Michael Beinhorn, who produced a bunch of like amazing rock albums in the 90s. One of my all-time favorites was Soundgarden Super Unknown. I worked with Korn and Hole and Marilyn Manson and, you know, just all kinds of like Red Hot Chili Peppers and just like all kinds of like just amazing rock stuff. And I was like, wow, I think I would like to manage producers. I think that's the way I was thinking about it. So, you know, a year goes by and you know, I'm committed. I'm in there. Like, it was very open door policy, ask questions, you know, read Billboard magazine, look at contracts, whatever I wanted to do to learn.
Oh, there was so no, cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but you know, a year goes by and it's like, okay, I need a job.
Yeah. You can only do that for so long, for sure.
Right. So a little bit before I started that internship, I had had a job interview with a guy at BMI named Charlie Feldman. It was my first ever job interview, and they didn't have anything for me at the time, but I kept in touch with him. And, you know, I reached out saying, look, I really need work. And, you know, Charlie said, well, let me see what I can do. I don't, we don't have anything in my department, but maybe there's like an administrative job that you can do. And he, you know, he hooked me up with the right people. And I got like a sort of like an admin job. And, you know, I came into the company, and Charlie Feldman to this day is one of my absolute favorite guys in the business. He just retired this year, and, you know, it's kind of making me feel a little old because the guy who gave me my first interview is now retiring. But, you know, I went there knowing that it wasn't exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to really be in a creative environment. And not that BMI isn't creative, they just didn't have any jobs in that creative department for me. So, you know, I met a woman who started a little bit before I did, named Samantha Cox, who's still there and now runs that writer relations department in New York. You know, and she was sort of in the same, like she was in an administrative role, and, you know, we just became pals and we would go out and see stuff together. And then she got one of the, you know, she got the cool job, and moved into that department. And, you know, I about two years, maybe a year and a half into my 3 years at BMI, I had met David Foster's younger sister, James Foster, who was, you know, A&R in his record label, 143 Records, which went through Atlantic Records. And she played me an artist. I met her through my uncle, who was very close with her husband at the time, another publishing legend named Leeds Levy. She had played me this woman named Beth Hart. And it was a priority artist for them. And she just, she handed it to me and said, you know, I'd love to get your thoughts on this. And, you know, and I didn't know why she was asking or anything like that. And, you know, she and her husband and my Uncle Bob went out to dinner, and I stuck back because I wanted to give it my full attention. So I listened to the album. I think the song was called L.A. Song. When she came back from dinner, I said, you know, I listened to this already, and I think that L.A. Song is like a complete hit. And she looks at me and goes, that's so funny. That's the song the label picked this week to be the first single.
And were there just gears in your brain at all? Did you think much about it at that time? That's pretty cool.
The thing is that, like, I always liked to do that stuff even before I even thought about getting into the music business. I always liked to listen to albums and, like, pick my favorite song, you know, right. Like, mm-hmm. song, like, yeah. I'm sure everybody does that in their own way, but, like, I really, like, would just go through it, you know, and this is my favorite, this is my second favorite, my third favorite. Like, I really just kind of like to do that. You know, even as a kid, I was like, you know, the stuff that was getting played on the radio, I would like record it on cassette so that I could, you know, if it was like something that I really liked, this way I wouldn't have to wait for it to come back on the radio. I can just play it over and over again. So, you know, like a week goes by and I hear from James Foster that they'd like to bring me on as a A&R consultant for 143 to be like their New York East Coast guy that would like go out and check out shows for them or find talent or whatever it was. And I, it was a consultancy and I had a full-time job at BMI. So I couldn't afford to give up the full-time company job with, you know, the medical benefits and all that good stuff. I went to my higher ups at BMI and I told them about it, and you know, they knew how passionate I was about like going out and being in the creative world. And David Foster, you know, who's an unbelievable legend, you know, is a big BMI writer. So they were cool with it because they figured maybe that would be like a good way to just, you know, have another great relationship with BMI and David. So, you know, they were like, as long as it doesn't interfere with your day job, we're fine with it. And so I did it. I did it for, I think, about a year. And then they had decided not to continue with a New York role. And that was fine. You know, it was a consultancy, so I didn't really expect it to go that, you know, as long as it did anyway. You know, it's either going to be what it is or turn into something real. So I, at that point, had kind of decided that it was time for me to move on from BMI. Again, just like with Desmond and team, I'm still incredibly close with everyone at BMI. You know, Samantha Cox, Barbara Kane in the LA office is a mentor to me. You know, Mike O'Neill, who's the chairman, is always unbelievably kind to me. You know, so I value that relationship with BMI more than I can even explain. And right before I left, I got a call from Winston Simone, Desmond's manager, and a guy named David Simone, who was a publishing legend with Polygram Music Publishing, which is now Universal. And he also ran Geffen Records after David Geffen had left. And they were starting a publishing company called Destined Songs, so it would be Desmond Child and Winston and David as partners. And they were trying to track down the guy who let the dogs out. You know, and BMI has a great system of finding writers and all that. And Who Let the Dogs Out was a song that was popular in certain territories, not really in America yet. And they were looking to track it down because they wanted to use it for Steve Greenberg, who was the founder of S-Curve Records, who, like, you know, worked with Hanson back in the day and Joss Stone and, you know, and was, you know, working with the Baha Men. They wanted to use that song. And I guess the deal was that, you know, S-Curve Records was going to, you know, cut the song with the Baha Men and Destin Songs. It was going to be like one of the first things they did, you know, publishing wise. They signed the writer. So I found the guy. He was like a writer in Trinidad. His name was Anselm Douglas. And, you know, connected him with the Destin Songs guys. And, you know, one of the last things I did was at BMI was I signed him up to BMI. You know, that wasn't my department, but I basically connected him with, I think it was Charlie or you know, whoever it was at the time. And they brought him in. And, you know, as I'm sure, you know, many people will know, it, you know, Who Let the Dogs Out was like, you know, right, a massive sports anthem. You know?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
So the performance money on that was ridiculous, and you know, merchandising and all that stuff. So it, you know, like it was the theme song to the first ever Subway Series, the 2000 World Series between the Yankees and the Mets.
Wow.
And I got to go to game five where they actually performed it. And you know, not to throw it in all the, you know, I'm a Yankees fan, so not to throw it in all the Mets fans' faces, but the game started off with a first pitch home run by Derek Jeter. So, you know, it was awesome. And then right after that, I left BMI, which was the first, I basically left to go to work at a startup, which back then they called them .coms because, you know, the internet was like, you know, blowing up.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, I don't even remember what the company was called or what they did. It was just, it was music business related, and I wanted to get out, figure out where I fit in. And I went there, and I just remembered, like, hating it. I was miserable. I don't remember the name of the company or even what my role was. I just knew that, like, wow, I hope I didn't make a mistake here. And I was just miserable, and I kind of, like, talked to my family. Because again, I'm like in my early 20s at this point. I don't know anything. So I'm talking to my family, and I'm just like, you know, I was taking care of my grandfather at the time, and you know, I called up my family, and I'm just like, look, I really want to be in the music business. I really am trying to figure out what I want to do in the music business, and I'm gonna walk away from this startup job because it's just like I just couldn't stand being there, and you know, I'm going to give it 6 months to really find something that I love in the music business in New York. And if I don't find anything, you know, I kind of told my dad and my uncle that, like, you're going to have to maybe, you know, make arrangements for my grandfather, which I hated doing because my connection with my grandfather was incredibly close, you know, because I may have to go look outside of New York. But fast forward to 6 months later, almost to the day, and I get a call from Destin Songs that they'd like to bring me in on a trial basis, you know, just because I had worked with Desmond and Winston, but David Simone didn't really know me at the time. And just, you know, to see how it goes, we'll try it out for like 3 to 6 months and then, you know, figure it out from there. So obviously I accepted it. It was a publishing company, and it was doing management stuff as well. And you know, I went in there, and just like I did with my internship, I really worked my butt off. And you know, the 3 to 6 months trial period, they offered me a full time position within like 3 weeks.
Wow! And this was in New York City?
In New York City, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and this was 2000.
Mm, okay.
So, yeah, so 20 years ago, I kind of was brought in to sort of handle a lot of the coordination stuff with the management and the publishing, sort of be the liaison with the LA, Miami, and Nashville offices. Worked with some really cool writers, and you know, this was right around the same time that American Idol was happening. Mm-hmm. And Desmond had been like hosting the writer camps for the first couple of seasons of American Idol, you know, including Kelly Clarkson and Ruben Studdard and Clay Aiken, you know. So like just really cool time to be involved in a publishing company. And then there was also the management aspect to it where, you know, not only was it Desmond and Michael Beinhorn, but they were managing Andreas Carlson, who had written Bye 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 for NSYNC and a bunch of other, you know, Britney and Backstreet Boys stuff. And they were managing a guy named Mark Hudson, who wrote Living on the Edge for Aerosmith. And then, you know, the writers they had signed there were like Gary Burr, who's, you know, country music songwriter, Hall of Fame inductee, and just written with everyone you can think of, from Carole King to, you know, Garth to just everyone. And Victoria Shaw, who wrote some massive hits for Garth Brooks as well. And, you know, it was just like writing with some really just unbelievable, I mean, working with just some really unbelievable talent. And then there was the management aspect of it. Also had a pop group that had a big hit in the early 90s named Wilson Phillips, which is the daughters of Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys and John and Michelle Phillips from the Mamas and the Papas. They had reunited while I was working there, and Winston and David managed them. So, you know, I had gotten involved sort of as a day-to-day guy for them. And I just, you know, just like really just fun stuff. And they had broken up for 10 years. And then they were asked to perform at a tribute show at Radio City Music Hall to Brian, you know, for Brian Wilson. And, you know, being backstage with them, I got in an elevator and, you know, Paul Simon gets on the elevator and it's just like, wow, how do I keep my cool right now?
Right.
And then, you know, I go up to the dressing room, Paul Simon gets off the elevator and I go get Wilson Phillips and we get back on the elevator and we go down like 2 floors and we get off the elevator and we're standing face to face with Elton John, you know. Wow. You know, you can't make that kind of stuff up. Like, no. I went from an elevator with Paul Simon to an elevator with Elton John. And anyway, so, you know, it was really great. Made some really good friends. I was there for 4 years. The Nashville office, which was at the time run by a woman named Kerry Edwards, who's now Luke Bryan's manager. And then there was a woman named Becca Tischer, who's one of my, you know, dearest friends in the business. She now manages Julia Michaels. I was working a lot with them because, you know, I was still just like a country music fan. And then I, you know, sort of became, you know, a point person in New York for writers like Gary and Victoria, who had a lot of experience in Nashville or in the pop world as well. And, you know, it was just like, it was just an awesome, awesome experience for me. And then about 4 years in, I wasn't really looking, but I had gotten approached to, by a guy named Monty Olson, who, was running A&R for BMG Music Publishing at the time, or the original BMG Music Publishing, I should say. It was ultimately sold to Universal, and now there's a new BMG Music Publishing, or BMG Rights Management. Which, you know, we got connected through a mutual friend, and I had lunch with him, and, you know, he was looking for an A&R manager to be like the guy in New York. You know, because he was West Coast based and he needed somebody in New York. And we had a great meeting, you know, hour and a half lunch, just trading stories. And I came back feeling like, wow, that was really cool. You know, again, I wasn't looking for a job. I was happy where I was, but then I started thinking about it and I'm like, you know, maybe it's time for me to go out and do something different and sort of have my career evolve a little bit. And, you know, so I followed up with him, you know, for a couple of months and he kept writing me or calling me and saying, you know, you're still very much in the running. We're just taking a minute to make this decision. I guess they were probably looking at other people. I don't really know what took so long, but, you know, with corporate jobs, there's always something. So like March of 2004, I get a call from him. We'd like for you to meet with Scott Francis, who's the president of the company. And I said, okay, great. What's good for him? And they give me a date. It actually happened to be my 30th birthday. and I had like a big party planned for my 30th birthday, but, you know, we moved that to a couple days early so I could do my job interview.
Yeah.
And I went in, like, Scott just, you know, the president of the company is like, oh my God, I feel so bad for making you come in on your birthday. And I was like, well, please, were you crazy? And again, I had a great meeting with him. You know, it was like a really cool time at that company because Maroon 5 was breaking and Christina Aguilera, they published, and just, you know, I was really like excited to get the job at that point. I was into it. Like, I came out of that meeting feeling great. Called Monty and let him know. And I said, you know, listen, I would really love this. And, you know, hopefully, you know, I'm being considered. And like 2 or 3 days later, he calls me up and he goes, all right, we got one more meeting for you. It's the chairman of the company, Nick Firth, you know, who's a legendary publisher. His family was in publishing. And I'm like, you know, of course, obviously, you know, not only would I like to meet the chairman of BMG Music Publishing, but if that's what it takes to get the job, of course.
Yeah.
So I went in, and Nick, who I have a lot of respect for Nick. I had a little trouble figuring him out in that interview. He was tough. And I came out of it feeling like not as good as I did with the first two meetings. And I'm like, wow, I may have blown this. Not that I did anything wrong. He was just a tough read. You know, like he didn't crack any jokes. It was more like he didn't really want to know me. He just kind of wanted to know who I knew, and, you know, cause it's all about relationships and all that stuff. So I just felt like,
yeah.
So I, came out of it like feeling like, you know, I didn't think I blew it. I just didn't feel as good about it as I did the first two meetings. And I got a call from Monty the next day offering me the job. And, you know, yeah. And I was like so excited, but at the same time, I was terrified because, and I don't really do terrified, but I was terrified because I had to now go tell, you know, Destin Songs that I was leaving. And I said, to this day, these guys are like family to me. So like having to tell them that I was going was incredibly hard. Still one of the hardest things I think I've ever had to do in the business, you know, was leaving them. But it just felt like it was time, and there was nothing personal. Like, I wasn't upset with anyone. It just felt like I needed to go and have another next chapter in my career.
Yeah, for sure.
So I told them, and they were understanding. They were, you know, obviously left on great terms. There was no, you know, there, I mean, everybody was upset because, again, we're all incredibly close. But they understood it. At the end of the day, they understood. And so, you know, off I went to BMG Music Publishing. You know, had a lot of fun there. Like I said, Maroon 5, Christina Aguilera, Monty had signed some great stuff like All American Rejects and Chris Daughtry. And, you know, it was just a really cool time. And I was brought in as sort of like a songwriter rep, you know, get the writers co-writes and take their songs and pitch them for artists that are looking for songs. You know, look after the catalog, and it's assigned me a couple of really cool catalogs to look after, which, like, one of them was B.B. King, you know, so I got to meet B.B. King. You know, like, you know, you know, when you grow up like a U2 fan, Rattle and Hum, there's, you know, they have a duet with B.B. King called When Love Comes to Town. So now I'm actually meeting B.B. King. So not only is that cool, but it's like, wow, he's worked with Bono, you know?
Yeah. So when you're looking after catalogs, you're just in charge of, you know, like any licensing that comes through, or?
Yeah, just sort of like, you know, manager calls up, says, what kind of activity is the film and TV division getting? Or,
gotcha.
You know, there's a song in the catalog that could work for so-and-so artist. You know, maybe I could pitch it for that. Mm-hmm. You know, just sort of, you know, yeah, just kind of coverage, you know,
yeah.
with those, a lot of those catalogs, especially somebody like B.B. King and the other, you know, like another classic, they're, you know, amazing catalog at BMG at the time is the Bee Gees, you know, a lot of that stuff just kind of speaks for itself. So it's more about just making sure that, you know, the representatives for the catalog are you know, in the loop on what's going on. And then you can always find, like, you know, back then, covers albums were like a big thing, you know, like Rod Stewart was doing them, Neil Diamond was doing them, Julio Iglesias, you know, Bette Midler. So you could always find homes for these like iconic songs, you know, on covers albums. Barry Manilow, yeah, just a, you know, classic. Yeah. So I wasn't really supposed to be a guy that was like signing artists or writers, you know, but obviously that's part of being in the A&R world. You know, you go out to see shows, you hear about bands that are buzzing or writers that are working with, you know, major artists, and, you know, you have to do that stuff. So I was invited out to see an artist on Epic Records, but I can't tell you the name of it. I just honestly don't remember. And, you know, because he was looking for a publishing deal, and the manager invited me down, and I wasn't really into it, but I met these two ladies in the audience, in a sister act called the Pierces. It's Allison and Catherine Pierce. And we just talked a little bit. I didn't hear any music because they weren't performing that night. But I was kind of fascinated by their story. They were born in Alabama, and they spent some time in Nashville, and they were making an album for Republic Records that's sort of like singer-songwriter stuff with a little bit of pop in there. And, like, you know, I was like, I reached out to the manager the next day, and I said, listen, you know, again, whatever the artist's name was, wasn't really for me, but I'd like to know more about the Pierces. And he called me up, and he said, look, what's your address? I'll send you the album. You know, I listened to it probably 10 times that day. You know, again, doing what I do and just kind of like picking out my favorite songs.
Yeah,
and I'm
sure.
I'd really like to like sit down with them and, you know, get to know them a little bit, you know, more intimately, because we were in a very loud, you know, show.
Right.
So he's like, so come up to my office and I'll, you know, you guys can sit and hang here, and they'll bring their guitar and sing you a couple songs. And I'm like, well, they don't have to perform for me. I just kind of want to get to know them a little bit. We can always go see a show at another point. He's like, no, they love doing that stuff. So I went up there, and yeah, I basically got a private concert from the Pierces. And, you know, I put it on Monty Olson's radar, and I said, listen, this is something that I'm really kind of excited about. I think that these women are incredibly talented. They're beautiful singers. They're beautiful women, and they're amazing songwriters. And, you know, I'd like to take a look at the publishing. And he goes, okay, so send me the album. And I sent it to him, and, you know, felt like they would have a strong presence in the film and TV world for placements. He said, see if they could set up a show, and I'll come into New York, and we'll go see them and hang with them and the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they did that. He flew in, and, you know, we made an offer, and we got the deal, and it was my first ever signing. First time I ever signed a songwriter.
Wow.
Yeah. And then, you know, they that album didn't do so well, but, they took some time. They kind of reinvented themselves a little bit. They came out with an album called 13 Tales of Love and Revenge. And the album went gold in London. They got some opening dates with Coldplay. One of the songs off of that album became the theme song to Pretty Little Liars, which was a TV show that I think went on for like 9 or 10 seasons.
Yeah, it was a big
show. The deal did well. And so that was my sort of first signing. Well, no, it wasn't. Not sort of, excuse me. It was my first signing. At that time, I was pitching songs, I was getting placements, I was doing really well, and I was very happy. You know, I really loved working with Monty. We're still very good friends to this day. I'm pretty good at keeping my relationships. I don't like to burn bridges. So, you know, when I say that, like, I'm friends with these people, even all these years later, I legitimately am. Sometimes I just reach out to say hi. It, you know, I don't need a business reason to reach out to people that I care about. A little bit further down the line, you know, Monty and the president, Scott Francis, had said, listen, we know that you like country music, so we would like for you to start spending a little time in Nashville working with some writers down there that have expressed interest in doing some stuff in pop. And then maybe if we have some pop writers, you know, you can be the guy that, like, has the synergy with the Nashville office. Because back then, Nashville was treated sort of as its own territory. You know, so I was like, I would love to do that. First of all, I hadn't been to Nashville at that point. And I had signed another artist named John McLaughlin, who I describe him as like Billy Joel piano playing, because he's just a sick ass piano player. And he had like a John Mayer-esque voice.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, he was signed to Island Def Jam at the time. He had gotten a really great, like, opening slot for Kelly Clarkson for an entire tour in the U.S. And just had a lot of momentum. And, you know, I went to his A&R guy, whose name was Josh Sugan, and said that, you know, I think that he would be really great with some, like, Nashville writers. And he said, we'll put together a list and let me know what you think. And I reached out to the Nashville office, and the first guy that came to mind was a guy named Marcus Humman, who wrote Bless the Broken Road for Rascal Flatts.
And you had known him, or?
I knew him a little bit. Okay. He had been spending a lot of time in New York, because he's also like, he's also like, he does a lot of theater work and all that stuff. And Desmond had a long relationship with him, but I didn't meet him through Desmond. I met him through BMG.
Okay.
You know, we had a meeting in New York, and then I reached out and, you know, they told me that the Nashville office told me that Marcus would be great for this and he would love to do it. And, you know, I spoke to him directly because we knew each other a little bit. And he said, yeah, I mean, I like his stuff. You know, John is a Christian and, you know, similar writing style to Marcus. And Marcus literally, like, Marcus just came off a Grammy for Bless the Broken Road.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I thought, well, John lives in the middle of Indiana. We're going to have to get John to Marcus. And Marcus was like, nope, I'll hop in my truck and drive up there right now. you know.
Wow.
And yeah, so that kind of opened the door for me to start spending more time in Nashville. There was a writer named Chris Lindsay who's worked with Tim McGraw and Faith Hill and Kelly Pickler. And I met him in LA at a little retreat we did on his wife, Amy Mayo. You know, they're both incredible songwriters. And Chris had reached, you know, Chris was one of those guys that, like, you know, I really would love to do some more pop stuff. And we sent him to Sweden, and he'd written with Jorgen Ellefsen, who's a big writer and producer over there. And then, like, there was another writer named Luke Laird, who was very new to the songwriting scene in Nashville.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wanted John McLaughlin to write with him. And, you know, Luke was like, absolutely, I'd love to do it. I'll pull in somebody, you know, so that, you know, we can have a great third writer in there. And the third writer ended up being Hillary Lindsay, who's by far and away, you know, one of the not only the best songwriters of all time, but, you know, still one of the biggest songwriters in Nashville, everything from Carrie Underwood to Lady Gaga, you know. So it was like, she was already a big name at that point. And, like, I was honored that Luke was able to pull her in. She wanted to do it. You know, she had written Jesus Take the Wheel for Carrie Underwood, and she was a big deal.
Yeah, huge song.
And then I started reaching out to other people like Brett James and Troy Burgess, and they were all into it. I think they just liked what they heard from John. So that gave me a little street cred down here working with, you know, Luke Laird is now one of the premier writers in Nashville.
Yeah.
at our church in Little Big Town, and you know, just you know, amazing stuff. He's worked with Casey Musgraves, and so yeah, again, it gave me a little bit of street cred down here. So I just started coming back and forth to Nashville, New York, and I guess it was around 2007. Universal purchased BMG Music Publishing. And before they did that, right, like the year leading up to that, about a year and a half leading up to that, I had signed my old friend Victoria Shaw, who, you know, I knew from Destined Songs. And she was working with, she was really like, you know, developing Hillary Scott from Lady A. You know, who was a teenager at that point. So Victoria had the publishing, and we picked up the admin deal on Hillary Scott. So, you know, we were involved in her publishing as well. And, you know, then Hillary met the other two guys and Lady A was born.
Yeah.
And so at the same time, I had, you know, right around the same year, I had gone to a songwriter retreat called the Durango Songwriters Expo, which was founded in Durango, Colorado, and it still goes on in Colorado every year. I still attend the one in Colorado. I haven't, obviously, this year it was canceled, and last year I couldn't make it, but normally I you know, Colorado is like one of my favorite places, so I take a little vacation and I go do the retreat. And then they do one in L.A., back then, they were doing like a random third one in a very odd, like remote part of the world. Like they would just pick a different city somewhere in the country.
Yeah.
And they did one at Rio Rico, Arizona, which was the first one I had attended. Rio Rico is like walking distance to the border, and then an hour south of Tucson, I guess. So I met a writer there named Alyssa Moreno, who was the talk of the conference because she was doing well in the film and TV world, but she had written a song with Jeffrey Steele, who's, you know, another legend in Nashville. You know, has written tons of cuts with, like, he wrote What Hurts the Most for Rascal Flatts. So the song that she wrote with him was a song called Every Day, and the Rascal Flatts were going to cut it. And every publisher that was attending the conference was, you know, talking to Alyssa, and she was LA based. So I was New York based. So it was a little hard for me to, you know, maintain a relationship with her from the other coast. But like, we really just hit it off at the conference. I didn't try and sell her on money or anything. I just kind of sold her on, like, you know, like, this is, you know, really great with songwriters, and like, I'd love to work with you. And we just kept talking and talking and talking, and, you know, ultimately I got the deal. So that Rascal Flatts single was just an album track at the time, and it became the third single off the album. And it was like literally the same week that the very first Lady A song came out, called Love Don't Live Here Anymore. So out of nowhere, this New York publisher had the number one and two song on the country charts.
Wow.
Yeah. So again, I just started, you know, I just kind of used that to my advantage to start spending more time in Nashville. I would never come into Nashville and tell the publishers here, who I have so much respect for what they do, and the record labels and the songwriters, so much respect for the creativity that comes out of the city, that I would never dare to come in here and say, hey guys, I'm from New York and I know more about country than you do. I would never do that.
Right.
I just kind of came in and respectfully found ways that I could work with, you know, some great writers and some great executives in this town, not step on toes, let me help bring some stuff into the pop world. Maybe I can help bring some pop stuff into the country world. You know, that's all I ever wanted to do. I just wanted to work here because I'm really passionate about, I'm passionate about country music, but I'm passionate about songwriters, and I'm passionate about, the city. I just think the city is just so unbelievably creative. And I just really love spending time here. I think also part of, you know, me growing up a little bit in San Antonio, I had a flavor for the South. So, you know, I was at Universal when all this stuff was going on, and a company, a family owned independent publisher named Pure Music had reached out to me. A guy named Sam Kling, who I'd worked with at BMG, and said, you know, we'd love to bring you in and kind of keep doing what you're doing as far as, you know, the pop and country stuff. They had an iconic catalog of just all this amazing bluegrass stuff and a Latin catalog. They were getting really hot on the charts because they published Tricky Stewart, who wrote Rihanna's Umbrella. And then when I came into the company, Beyonce's Single Ladies was the hit. So just to backtrack a little bit, I have this very weird timing thing where, you know, like when I interned for Desmond, Live in La Vida Loca was the song, right? Like the song on the radio.
Yeah.
And then I went back to work for Desmond at Destin Songs, and it was Who Let the Dogs Out. And then, you know, go over to BMG and you've got all these amazing Christina Aguilera songs and, you know, Maroon 5 with She Will Be Loved, and, you know, and then I could appear and it's like, oh, Beyonce's Single Ladies.
Yeah. So the, I just the biggest song. You just don't
I just seem to come to these publishing companies as like they're having just monstrous, you know, iconic hits in the pop world.
Yeah.
So, you know, I went to Pier, and it was cool because I kind of came full circle. You know, I'd worked with David Foster very early on, and Pier is his publisher, so I got to work with David a little bit more, which, you know, I love David Foster. He's, you know, like, really just a cool guy. And, you know, I was there for 3 years. I was going back and forth a lot between between Nashville and L.A. and New York, and just doing what I could to fit in and, you know, pitch songs and find deals. And just really, you know, right as I was on my way out, Esther Dean was becoming a thing. And she had been signed to Pier at the time and, you know, had Katy Perry's Firework. You know, so it was just a really, like, cool time, you know, for the pop side of my life. I was there for, yeah, I guess 3 years. This was probably 2008 to 2011. I went on to work at Razor and Tie for a year. Desmond's managers, Winston and David, they had said that they had this classical group called the Piano Guys. It's four guys from Utah that do like classical mashups of famous songs. Like the thing that kind of put them on the map was they did a classical mashup of One Direction's That's What Makes You Beautiful. Then they made a really cool video with it where the whole band is like playing the same piano. Mm. Like, you know, just kind of a couple of the guys would be like inside the piano, like pulling away the strings, and then there'd be some guys at the, you know, at the keys and all that stuff. And they would do like, they took all of the Batman themes from, like, you know, all the movies and then the TV show in the 60s. And they made a video of that with like all the different Batmobiles. And then they like wrote half the album as well. So there was publishing available. So I brought it into Razor and Tie, and, you know, again, I've never worked in classical music. I don't know too much about it, but these guys were just cool. Like, and, you know, now to this day, they've had over a billion views on YouTube with all their different videos.
Yeah, they seem to be ahead of the curve in terms of making, like, the interesting video that a lot of bands are trying to be like that on YouTube now. Yeah.
Right. And these guys would literally do all of the physical labor to make the video themselves. I remember helping them. They were doing some Christmas stuff in New York, and we were all pushing a piano out onto the ice skating rink at Bryant Park.
Oh,
Not exactly the safest thing to do.
Yeah.
But, you know, these guys were just really creative with their videos.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, so I did a little road management work for them as well, and I just, you know, just like really awesome guys. So another one, like I met Razor and Ty, and they had a writer named Greg Holden who wrote Philip Phillips, you know, who's another Idol winner. They wrote his his first single called Home, which went on to be like the theme song for Superstorm Sandy in 2012.
Right. And for the troops, right, maybe. I think they used it.
Yeah, exactly. Things, and yeah. Like, it was, well, I mean, I'm from Staten Island, and, you know, Staten Island got hit really hard with that storm. And that, so again, like, I come into another company, and there's another monster song.
Yeah.
You know, and then, so from there, I went to, there's three pronunciations of this company. It was a Dutch-based company, and the company's the proper pronunciation, which, you know, I don't have a European accent, so forgive me. It's it was called Imagen. It's spelled I-M-A-G-E-M, like, so image with the letter M at the end. You know, we at the office here in America just called it Imagen. A lot of the creatives, a lot of the writers and producers just called it Imagen. So it just kind of depended on who you asked.
Yeah.
So I came in there into the A&R department, and so once again, perfect timing. I'm there for about 3 months, and they published Mark Ronson and Uptown Funk premieres on Saturday Night Live, and you know, becomes
a song
of that year. You know, it's like, so again, here I am with another iconic pop song, and you know, it was like really just amazing. You know, they had it won BMI song of the year.
Yeah, yeah. And like, what's going on in a company when a song does that, when a song becomes such a smash? If you've seen it happen in all these different companies, what's going on within the company when something like that happens?
I mean, obviously, there's a lot of excitement, and you know, when you have a song like Uptown Funk, film and TV division, you know, they're having a good time because they're getting unbelievable high priced license requests for commercial. Yeah. So it's, you know, that's a cool thing, especially when you're like in an independent publisher, you know, to have a song like that on the chart and then to have it win song of the year, the BMI awards. It's like, you know, those kinds of things are really normally dominated by the majors, by Sony ATV and Universal and Warner.
Yeah, definitely.
So when it happens for an independent, which again, it's like, that's happened to me several times with an independent, with, you know, with Single Ladies and, you know, Living La Vida Loca, and like, you know, just to be a small company to have hits, you know, to where hits like that are happening, there's just a vibe in the hallway that, like, you know, like, you know, everybody is just like, you know, what a great time to be at a company.
Yeah, they got some pep in their step, I bet.
right. And then, you know, so what was cool about that place was that, you know, I was in the pop division, and there was obviously Mark Ronson, and they had, you know, the big catalogs they had were, they also had Daft Punk, you know, which were, they were just coming off of their hit. And, you know, they had like Phil Collins and his whole catalog. And then what was like really cool was they also had two other divisions. One was a big classical repertoire called Boosie and Hawks, which is one of the largest classical production libraries in the world. So, you know, it wasn't my department, but it was really like a cool learning experience for me to see how all that stuff went. And then they also owned all of the Rodgers and Hammerstein theater stuff. You know, Oklahoma.
Yeah,
Oklahoma. And I had never, ever gone anywhere near a theater division. I didn't understand, you know, obviously I know, oh, well, you already have a Broadway musical, and that's huge. But I never knew, like, how monstrous that aspect of the business was, just from, again, from the, you know, from Broadway to off-Broadway to everything. And, you know, you know, from like sheet music, you know, just sending sheet music to schools every year. I never thought about that kind of stuff before. Mm-hmm. It was just like, I didn't have any experience in it. So like I learned, you know, again, I was already pretty significantly into my career. And like I learned a lot from being at that company. Hmm. So I guess that puts us at about 2018. The company was sold to Concord Music. And I've been there for almost 4 years, and, you know, I was enjoying my time there, but, you know, corporate takeovers, you know how that stuff goes. So mm-hmm. just my time there had come to an end, you know, on great terms with them to this day. Like I said, I'll give Victoria Shaw a shout out for this. You know, one of the life lessons that she loves to talk about with me is, you know, don't burn bridges. So I left on great terms and no hard feelings. It just was time to move on to the next thing. And I wasn't sure what was next for me. New York had become really thin as far as just not only job opportunities, but a lot of, you know, just because the cost of living in New York is ridiculous. Yeah. You know, a lot of writers and producers were moving to Nashville and moving to LA. I knew I was going to have a really hard time finding a gig in New York. So, you know, I took all the meetings. I had sold my house on Staten Island, so I made a little bit of money. So that afforded me the opportunity to travel to L.A. and Nashville and just see where maybe I could fit in somewhere. And, you know, I didn't want to move to L.A. without, like, having a job. Because, again, it's, you know, L.A. is expensive as well. And I thought, like, the money could go a little further if I just took a risk and came to Nashville. But more importantly than that, I felt like my career had always been sort of gravitating towards coming to Nashville. You know, that's where my heart was. That's where I really enjoyed working the most. So, you know, I basically took a risk. I packed up my dog and got in the car, found a living situation, drove down here middle of last year, middle of 2019, let a bunch of my relationships, you know, my strong relationships, you know that I was coming, and I appreciate any support. Obviously, I had no expectations of just coming to town and finding a job, and I knew it was going to be a lot of networking and talking to people and finding just the right home, because, you know, this town is still very much a country town, and I'm sort of like a pop guy that likes to work in country, and so I didn't expect to get here and find something quickly. I just needed to take a risk with my life that I knew if I didn't take and I decided to move on and do something other than the music business, I was going to regret it. You know, I figured I'd come down here for 6 months, a year. And this way, even if it didn't work out, I could say I tried.
Yeah.
You know, and I got here and I did odd job stuff just to, you know, put some money in my pocket. I had a little bit of savings, you know, that was paying the rent, but obviously, you know, and not only that, you know, you can't look for a job 24/7, so you need to get out of the house a little bit, and, you know. Mm-hmm. I guess about this time last year, because the Country Music Awards are like first week of November, so I was out networking at all the events, the BMI and the ASCAP and the CSAC Awards, and some of the parties, and I was invited to a viewing party for the CMAs. Hmm. And I was there talking to people, and the writer I mentioned earlier that I had signed to Universal, Alyssa Moreno, was there, and, you know, I was kind of hanging out with her for a good chunk of the night. And there was a guy there named Michael August. And he was the general manager, or is the general manager, for Demolition Music Publishing. And I didn't really know too much about that company. And we got to talking a little bit, but it was a crowded party. So I just told him, you know, I gave him my cell phone number. And, you know, I woke up the next morning to a text from him saying, you know, we'd like for you to come over to the office and talk a little bit more. So I went over there and I sat down with them for a little bit. And it was fascinating to me because the founder and president of the company, a guy named John D'Agostino, is from my hometown of Staten Island. And he is a very successful personal injury attorney up in New Jersey now. And he's always had a passion for songwriting. He, you know, especially country music, it's very strange because I thought I was the only guy from Staten Island that's a Garth Brooks fan. And he is a guy from Staten Island who's a diehard Garth Brooks fan.
You found the only other one, right?
I'm sure there's more, but yeah, it's very strange to say that, like, there's more than one, you know, guy from Staten Island who's in the music business who's a Garth Brooks fan. That's rare. you know, so Michael and I had a really great conversation. I said, you know, listen, John's going to be in town in a couple weeks. Let's get something on the books. I had breakfast with them. You know, John and I hit it off. You know, we're from the same hometown, so it was an easy conversation. That was, I guess, that was probably like right before Christmas of last year. And we just were talking. We weren't really deciding on anything. Just kind of getting to know you, and you know, I got to know the company a little bit, and talking about some of the writers that were signed there. And the holidays came and went, and I reached out, you know, just to say I'd love to keep talking to you guys. And they wrote me right back saying, you know, we're in the middle of moving offices and just be patient with us because we want to keep talking to you as well. And, I should backtrack a little bit. When I moved down here, I told Desmond, and it just goes to show the strength of, you know, like I said earlier, that those guys are still family to me. I told Desmond that I was looking to take a little bit of a risk with my life and come down here and try and figure out, you know, moving forward with my career. And, you know, he said, well, you know, get a key to my office and use it as your home base. And, you know, he didn't have to do that.
Yeah.
You know, so, he doesn't, so great. You know, the fact that he trusts me to have access to his office was incredibly flattering, you know? So, you know, I tried to get over there as much as I could, but again, I was doing a lot of odd job stuff. So, you know, there were times where I didn't get to use it as much as I wanted. But in the beginning of this year, he asked to sit down with me because Desmond has a joint venture publishing deal with Sony ATV, and he has two writers signed to it. One writer is Levi Hummond, who's Marcus Hummond's son, and the other is a guy named Drake Milligan, who, if anybody has seen the miniseries that was on CMT about Sun Studios, he played Elvis. So Drake is also signed to Broken Bow Records, and they were looking for like a day-to-day guy because his manager's in LA. And, you know, they just needed somebody that could just sort of keep everything organized, and I have a lot of experience in the management stuff, so it was, you know, Desmond knew that I was the right fit for the job, so he recommended me for it. And, you know, I've been working with Drake for almost a year now, and he's just an unbelievably talented guy. He, you know, the album is coming soon, and, you know, everyone should just keep an eye out for Drake Milligan because he's...
Yeah, for sure.
He's you know, for a young guy in his early 20s, I've never seen anyone that knows as much about like legit old school traditional country as you do. Like, you know, his idol is George Strait, and Elvis, and you don't hear that from too many, like, early, you know, 20-somethings.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So, you know, like, the more time I spend with him, the more I just really wanted to appreciate him as a, you know, as a real, like, legitimate talent. And, you know, I'm excited to see what comes next for him, you know, like, proud to say that I work with him. So then moving forward, mid-February, late February of this year, I've run into Mike August, the GM of Demolition, at a show. And I just kind of pulled him aside and I made a real hard pitch on myself because, you know, I knew this was my moment to really talk to him. Mm-hmm. And just said, listen, you know, you guys are a building company. You've been around for a couple of years. You guys are making some real strides. If you were to bring somebody in like me, you know, I really feel like my relationships, not just in Nashville, but around the world, really, especially in New York and LA, can really benefit to kind of like raise awareness for the brand and bring in some new opportunities for you guys to get involved in. And, you know, I would love, you know, listen, I kind of love the idea of it because to get in on the ground level and help build something like just seemed really cool to me. I'd never done anything like that before. Like, I've always worked at corporations, whether they were, you know, major companies like Universal or family owned like Peer or Concord, you know, which is, you know, an amazing indie. They were bigger. This is really like, you know, this is indie.
Yeah.
But I started to get to know Mike and John, and I was really respecting what they were trying to do. And, you know, and I really thought that, like, wow, you know, as much as I feel like I could benefit from working with them, because, again, the idea of getting in on a ground level of a company that was a couple of years old, but they really hadn't, you know, they were really still building. And then for, you know, it was like amazing to me. And then I knew that, like, my relationships and experience with the bigger companies and just, you know, having just great relationships everywhere, I felt like I could be a real asset to them. So we got to talking and, you know, I guess it was like end of February, John had offered me the position of head of A&R starting April 1st, and I accepted. And I guess, I mean, I knew I was starting the job officially April 1st. Obviously, you know, we were talking in February, so I was kind of like getting familiar with the place before I had officially started. And then the whole damn world went into quarantine.
Yeah.
So now I'm like working with Drake, who, you know, things are now slowed down a little bit because of the quarantine stuff, because he can't tour.
Yeah.
And I'm working with Demolition, and I can't even go to the office. And, you know, I'm like wanting to meet the writers because that's, you know, that's my gig. Like, I'm the writer relations guy, right?
Yeah.
You know,
the
head of the A&R department. And I, you know, I basically had to meet everyone through Zoom. There's, you know, here we are middle of October and, you know, I still haven't met like two or three of the writers in person.
Wow.
And I've been there for over 6 months now. So it was a little bit challenging to start a job that way.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Because, you know, I pride myself on my relationships and I pride myself on like walking into an event, a networking event, or walking into a record label with a writer and just being able to really communicate and network and schmooze and all that stuff. And, you know, and that's kind of what I sold Demolition on, was that, like, I'm a great relationship guy. And now we can't really do that. Right? So, you know, because, like, one of the things that I do is I'm on an education committee in New York for the Songwriters Hall of Fame, which is, you know, by far and away my favorite publishing event of the year. I've gone... Well, it didn't happen this year because of COVID, but I've gone, I think, 12 or 13 consecutive years. It's, you know, literally my favorite event to go to. And, you know, I was honored, you know, a couple of years ago, they asked me to be on the committee, which they do like a master class thing with Stuyvesant High School in Manhattan. And, you know, I was very much looking forward to going this year and being able to take John around the cocktail hour and, you know, through the event, introducing the to my people and just, you know, my connections and just really show him what I could do.
Yeah.
And then we couldn't do it. I felt like, wow, you know, and what's crazy is, you know, if COVID had happened, if the quarantine stuff had happened probably maybe a month before it officially went into, you know, like real deal nationwide lockdown, mm-hmm. I'm not sure I would have gotten the Drake job or the demolition job. You know, but thankfully the timing worked out for me on that one. You know, and now so on that demolition, 6 months, you know, head of A&R. I just signed my first writer which is a writer-producer here in town named Josh Ronan. We did that with a joint venture in Canada with a company called Arts and Crafts Music Publishing. And, you know, Josh is incredible, and he's got songs with Lava recording artist, Some Girl Named Anna. He's got a single with a guy named Spencer Crandall, which is doing like 100,000 streams a day. So like it's, you know, it just kind of came out two or three weeks ago, and we're almost, you know, we'll probably be at like 2.5 million by the end of the week.
Wow.
And Josh is just like, you know, he's exactly what I wanted. He was, you know, he kind of works in a few different genres, but he's also just a really good guy, and he's become like a friend. And I love that kind of stuff. I love having that working dynamic where like, we can talk work all day long, but if we also want to talk about, hey, what's going on this weekend, we can do that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, there was that. And then, you know, we have another writer, goes by the name of, her artist name is Haven. She's an incredible pop artist, songwriter. She has the current Iggy Azalea single, which, you know, just kind of randomly happened through a co-write,
mm-hmm.
You know, and Iggy loved the song so much that she asked Haven to, you know, go out to LA from Nashville and write some more with her. And I, you know, they've written a bunch of songs now, and Haven's decided to relocate out there. You know, and just like, you know, she's somebody to keep an eye on. She's really, she's super talented and, you know, just like an absolute sweetheart. And, you know, hopefully big things to come for Haven, and, you know, which would mean big things to come for Demolition.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's where we are.
Yeah. I mean, pandemic or not, you really seem to be rolling now with some songwriters and now managing. I know the pandemic has definitely hurt artists, so you were saying things really slowed down with management, but in terms of being in publishing, now that a lot of films and TV shows had shut down for a little while, were you feeling any of that in terms of just looking for licensing? Do you think that'll slow down a bit?
Well, it has slowed down a bit as far as, you know, well, I think it slowed down a bit, especially over the summer. You know, a lot of TV shows are on hold, and, you know, movies are the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the creative process, you know, it's kind of like a cool time for songwriters because, you know, it's hard to make movies and it's hard to make TV shows in a COVID world. But one thing that's not hard to do is make music.
Yeah.
Because songwriters, you know, as much as people are frustrated with the whole virtual thing, I keep telling my writers, you know, look at it this way. Zoom has, you know, Zoom or whatever virtual service they're using has now opened the door for songwriters to learn a whole new way to write songs. So, you know, God willing, we start to move past this COVID thing next year. And, you know, I say to writers, okay, so like now that you know how to write through Zoom, you know, what happens if like, you know, you want to go to LA, but can't necessarily afford to go to LA or family reasons or whatever it is. Now you can write a song with somebody in LA or London or Japan or wherever.
Yeah, anywhere.
Virtually, you know?
Yeah, the actual process of writing a song, you know, you can just be there with a guitar or be there with a co-write or something. So, yes, that's, you know, easier than the whole production of a movie. So I know what you mean by easier, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, like, I mean, listen, ultimately, you know, the ideal thing is to have writers in a room together.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, and because that's where you get the real creative vibe. But, you know, hopefully we'll get back to that world. But at the same time, I feel like, you know, this is a learning experience because, again, you know, not every writer can hop on a plane easily and go to Japan to write a song. So, you know, now they can do it this way. You know, not every writer can hop on a plane the next morning to go to something in L.A., but now they can do it this way.
Yeah.
So I just like, you know, I know a lot of creative, you know, writers and producers are, you know, frustrated and discouraged with the world we're living in, as is everyone else. But I'm trying to just encourage to say, again, it's a learning experience. And, you know, now you've learned a new craft with your songwriting skills.
Yeah. And I've been saying that even with artists who are doing the virtual shows. I've said this before, but I was thinking, like, there's no reason why those virtual shows need to stop when everyone starts touring. Because, again, what if a band can't travel to play for their fans in London or Australia? You know, now the production value on a virtual show is so great that,
100%.
You know, so it's so cool. And it's so interesting that you're with this newer company, this younger company. And part of me would think, like, wow, there's so many publishing, like little publishing companies here and there. But then I realized, but the streaming world has just opened up this whole avenue with so much, whether it's film or TV and all these streaming services, or even with Spotify.
Right.
And you think like, oh yeah, there has to be a lot of publishing companies. And it's so cool to be a young company in a world that's changing that fast. You can change with everything instead of being a company that's been doing it for 30 years and having to like catch up with any fast changes, you know, which you've experienced both, really.
Right. I mean, there's so much content out there that, you know, again, like for pitching purposes, look at all the TV shows that, you know, Netflix and Hulu and Amazon.
It's unreal. Every day, there's just,
you know, and then, you know, movies, you know, some movies aren't even getting theater releases anymore. They're going straight to the streaming services. So there's a lot more room to make movies. And then, you know, as far as music is concerned, there's just so much access, you know, with digital streaming platforms and digital distribution companies that, you know, artists that can't get major label deals for whatever reason, you know, have outlets and resources to get their music out there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's an exciting time in the business. I do. I think it's weird, again, but the whole world is weird right now. But, you know, it's like I'm curious to see what great albums, whether it's from, you know, Taylor Swift or Adele or, you know, like one of the big artists, or it's an unknown artist, you know, sitting in his bedroom because he can't go outside, you know, that just kind of, you know, kind of makes an album on his or her own. Like, I'm really curious to see what kind of music is going to be out there this time next year, because people are sitting at home right now doing nothing but creating.
Yeah. It's going to be a really interesting year for the arts in that way, for sure.
100%. So, yeah. An exciting time.
Yeah, man. Well, thank you so much. You've given me so much, and I appreciate you telling your whole story. It's fascinating, for real. And
thank you for having me on. You know, again, like we, you know, I said in the beginning, like, you know, my 25th anniversary in the business is just a couple months away. So yeah. I was really, you know, flattered that you guys reached out to me about this, because, you know, I've always kind of wanted to tell my story, and, you know, I don't think I'm ever going to write a book, but so this was a cool opportunity to get on and just, you know, share some stories. And, you know, if you guys ever need me back, I would be happy to come back.
Oh, thank you. That'd be awesome. Thank you, man. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you.